Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The St. Louis American newspaper is 85 years old this year. We'll be talking with publisher Donald Suggs a little bit later, after we go back a lot farther in history, 5,000 years or so. The ancient ring of stone in Britain we know as Stonehenge has been one of archaeology's mysteries. Who built it, when, and why? There have been many answers to the questions, but in recent years, it's all coming into much sharper focus. That's thanks in large part to our first guest, noted archaeologist Mike Parker Pearson. He's been looking into the Stonehenge secrets for a decade and more and believes he has uncovered many of them. Mike, so nice to have you with us.
That's great to be here. Thank you.
You know, I have to tell you, I've been fascinated by Stonehenge for a long time. But I grew up thinking that Stonehenge came about probably 1400-1500 or so, and that the Druids built it. How far off base could I more off base could I have been?
Well, that was the very first theory, really, about Stonehenge from 300 years ago, by an early archaeologist called William Stukeley, and that was at a time when we didn't really know anything about prehistory, so all he had to go on was what was written down by Julius Caesar, who invaded Britain in 55 BC. And Stukeley had worked out that Stonehenge was prehistoric, but that was all he could say about prehistory, was what Caesar had written. And Stukeley reckoned that Stonehenge must be some kind of a temple. And who could it be that worshipped in temples in Britain, according to Julius Caesar, but the Druids? Now, of course, Stukeley had no way of knowing that Stonehenge was 2,500 to 3,000 years earlier than that. I guess if he had known, he would probably not have ascribed it to them. But it stuck. And even today, a lot of people think that it was connected with Druids.
And that it was constructed about the time of King Arthur or so.
Yes, there are some people that still think that, even though we're very certain from radiocarbon dating that it's actually a long, long time before.
Well, what do we know? Do we know who built it?
I think we can say that all the inspirations for it you can find within the indigenous culture of what we call Neolithic Britain. So this is the point at which farming was adopted in Britain, and it's built within 1,000 years of the arrival of farming. Some people have said, well, was it built by ancient Egyptians, ancient Mycenaeans from Greece, or even space aliens? There are all sorts of ideas about external authorship for the monument. But I think we can be pretty certain that it's actually built by people within Britain at that time.
Farmers.
Yep, early farmers, yes.
Somehow that's a little less romantic than the Druids or some cult of some sort. Do we know why they built it?
We've got a number of different theories. The theory that we're working on at the moment is that this is a period of quite profound social change in Britain, when they move away from being isolated tribal territories to become a much more unified country. It's the first time in Britain that we actually see styles of pottery, styles of burial practice, styles of housing being uniform right across the country. And it's within that context that Stonehenge is constructed. We've been discovering recently that the resourcing of Stonehenge required food to be brought from a very wide area around it, so cattle being brought in on the hoof from as far away as northern Scotland, and that's some 700 miles away. Now, in Britain, that's a big deal. I can appreciate 700 miles doesn't get you very far in the area around St. Louis. But I think it's realizing that this involved everybody in Britain at that time. And we're now thinking this is part of a unification, albeit temporary, but a unification of the people of Britain.
And there are other similar kinds of sites, at least in terms of the geometry of them. Maybe not as spectacular, but similar.
Yes, Stonehenge is the most impressive example. It took far more labor to construct Stonehenge than any of the other stone circles. But just 20 miles away to the north is Avebury, another very impressive stone circle, and one we think was actually decommissioned around the time that Stonehenge was built.
Decommissioned?
We recognize that one of aspects of monument building that they're engaged in is to actually construct enclosures around pre-existing sites. These are actually what we call henges in archaeology. And typically a henge, it's not a standing structure. It's actually a bank and a ditch where the ditch is on the inside. And it's as if you're actually trying to keep something in. And what we've discovered about this particular type of monument is it's put up to commemorate, is put up when what was happening there before is finished. Now, of course, in the absurdity of archaeological definitions, Stonehenge by this definition is not a henge because it has its ditch on the outside. And so we have to call Stonehenge part of a group of formative henges, which are these enclosures with ditches on the outside, and which normally are used as cremation cemeteries. So the cremated remains of the dead were buried there.
And this is among your discoveries, finding out that this is, in fact, a burial site, or at least a burial site is close by.
That's right, yes. Yeah. The burial site is right there. Mm. So the enclosure itself, which was built around 3000 BC, so that's 5,000 years ago, starts off as a graveyard. And the stone circle that's first put up inside with quite small stones, but it's a much wider circle than the one that you see today. Even the holes for those stones, in some cases, included the ashes of the dead within them. So they're building not just a stone circle, but it itself is part of a cemetery.
What is unique about what you've been doing, as I understand it, is the fact that you have taken your dig, if you will, well beyond the site itself, outside the site. Mm-hmm. But what have you been finding there?
Well, I think there's been several things that have been really important. And the first was discovering that just under 2 miles away, along the River Avon, which is connected to Stonehenge by this very impressive avenue, there's the biggest henge in Britain. So it's a great big earthen enclosure. And that was sitting right on top the largest settlement we've ever seen in Britain for the Neolithic, for this early farming society. In fact, within the whole of Northwest Europe. It's called Durrington Walls, and it has timber circles, the most famous of which is Woodhenge, but there are several others as well. And it was there that we actually found the traces of all the houses for what we think is the building of Stonehenge. It looks like this was the builder's camp, and we reckon that there may well have been as many as 1,000 houses, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people living there.
And these, you say, suggest would be the builders rather than the farmers of the
period? Well, I think what we have to understand is that you're taking time out of the agricultural round to come and get involved in the building. And the two specific moments that you do this are in the midwinter, so chiming with the midwinter solstice, and also in the midsummer, because these are quite kind of downtimes in the agricultural year in prehistoric Britain.
And much has been made of the placement of the stones in Stonehenge because there is a certain series of alignments for the winter solstice and summer solstice.
Yes.
Was that misleading, do you think, for people trying to figure out what this was all about?
I think it was one of the key developments in theories about Stonehenge in the 1960s. And in fact, it was an American astronomer, Gerald Hawkins, who realized that not only was the monument aligned in one direction towards the midwinter solstice sunset and in the opposite direction to the midsummer solstice sunrise, but he worked out you could also use it as a kind of astronomical computer to calculate all sorts of things like the solar and lunar eclipses. Quite a number of those claims have been challenged by astronomers more recently, and I think we can be sure that the solstice alignments are there. We can also have some faith in the existence of lunar alignments for the moonrise and moonset in various directions. But the point is that these are only approximate. And what our project's astronomer has said is that really, if you wanted to do it accurately, and they knew how to do it accurately, you wouldn't do it with damn great stones. You'd actually do it with smaller timbers that you can move around to get that greater accuracy. Using stones means that you're making a monument of those orientations. And of course, we now know what those orientations at solstice tie in with, and it is the gatherings at the builder's camp to come and construct the monument, because we're able to find out from the teeth of the animals, particularly the pigs that they were feasting on, you can work out just how old they were when they were killed and barbecued. And we can see that most of them are killed at 9 months, and given that they're likely to be farrowing in the spring, that's going to be in the winter time, and then there's another peak 6 months later in the summer.
What remains to be learned from the site?
Well, you would have thought it had all been done, but that's so far from the truth. We're just beginning to learn about the area immediately around Stonehenge from comprehensive geophysical surveys. So using radar and magnetometry equipment to find out something of what's underneath the ground. We're also just starting to learn about where the stones themselves came from. Because although we've known the approximate areas, and famously the blue stones, these are the smaller stones at Stonehenge, came all the way from Wales, some 180 miles away. But up until now, no one's actually located the quarries. So this is a whole new area of research opening up.
My guest is Mike Parker Pearson, and he's an archaeologist who's been working for the last decade or so at Stonehenge in Britain. And he's learned a great deal, but there's much more, as you've just heard, to learn. We'll continue our conversation with him in just a moment, and I'd like to get you into it as well. 382-8255 is our telephone number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL On Air, and you can also reach us through Facebook. We'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about Stonehenge? Back in a moment. This is St. Louis On the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Mike Parker Pearson, the archaeologist, and we're talking about Stonehenge and the work that he's been doing there for a good many years now, trying to figure out what Stonehenge was all about, who built it, when and why, and many other things that remain to be learned. He will be discussing his Stonehenge findings later today, by the way, at Washington University's Steinberg Hall Auditorium. That is happening at 4 o'clock this afternoon, and I'm sure the folks there, Mike, will find it just as fascinating as I'm finding it here in this discussion with you.
Thanks.
Now, about the movement of these stones, It just boggles the mind. This predates the pyramids, the construction of it. Some of these stones weigh, 45 tons, did I read? And they come from 180 miles away. Do we have any real idea how that was accomplished?
Right. Well, it's we've got to think about the stones coming from two different sources, and they're two different sizes. So the ones that come from Wales, 180 miles, on average, they're only about 2 tons. The ones that when
is
you,
that all?
I'm afraid so, but that's still quite something. That takes a good gang of people, maybe 15, 20 people, to actually pull one of those. But the big ones that when you go to Stonehenge today that you see there, they're made out of the local sarsen is the name for it. And sarsen is a type of sandstone. And as you say, they're up to 45 tons, and they've just come from 20 miles away. Even so, to drag a big stone like that 20 miles takes a fair bit of organization. And we're beginning to look into where they may have come from and how they were moved. They may well have actually brought them all the way by land, the very big ones. And for that, you need not just a sledge to sit each of the stones in, and then you've also got to have rollers. They are so heavy that the rollers would just embed into the turf underneath. So they may even have had to set up some kind of wooden rails for the rollers to roll along. So however it was done, it's really quite complex and time-consuming.
And really would indicate how important this site was to them.
Yeah, and Stonehenge is the only monument, the only stone circle, that they actually bothered to dress the masonry, so to actually shape it with stone hammers. And that also, you know, in terms of millions of man-hours involved in doing that, that's also a huge involvement.
Many people not may not understand how sophisticated it was in the sense. I mean, there's a tongue and groove element to fitting some of these stones together. The lentils were placed in such a way so they could not be moved. Quite sophisticated for the time.
Yes, this mortise and tenon arrangement. So you've got a small bump on top of the upright so that the hole within the lintel sits straight onto it. You know, these are techniques classically that you find in carpentry. And what we've realized is that they're taking aspects of monumental timber structures that they're well acquainted with, that they've been building timber monuments like that for some time already, and they're saying, we're going to really show off and we're going to build it in stone as if it was wood. And I think that's one of the great things about the monument.
And many of the artist renderings I've seen of this, it shows a complete circle of stone. Mm. It's not a complete circle any longer. No. And there are some pretty big stones that are no longer there. Where the heck did they go?
Yeah. Well, you see, there's been one theory that, of course, it was never finished, which is why they're not there. We've had a good think about that. And a recent laser scan survey of the monuments really helped us to sort of focus in on this. One of the key things, though, is that we do know that some of the completely missing stones, there were holes dug for them, and they originally contained a stone. So there's been a lot of robbing on the site, and particularly the lintels, which I guess would have been quite easy to lasso and pull off, those have been taken away. Our excavations a few years ago recovered the wheel tracks of carts coming out of Stonehenge, obviously heavily laden to cause these really deep grooves in the ground. And they go in two directions. One down to the local town of Amesbury, which had an abbey built in, the 8th, 9th century AD, and the other to the village of Durrington, which had a church built in stone in the 11th century. And my suspicion is that's where quite a bit of Stonehenge ended up, in these two religious buildings.
Are they still there?
They're still there, and we've tried to see if we can see any of the Stonehenge stones broken up and included in the fabric, but unfortunately the surfaces are all plastered over.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Let's take some calls. We have our own archaeological wonderfulness right here in our area, and some folks want to talk about that with you. Mm. Let's bring in Teresa calling from Brentwood. Teresa, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call, and I'm enjoying the program. I don't know a great many details, but I have visited the Cahokia Mounds in Cahokia, Illinois, and I understand there was a timber circle there. Mm. And it's featured in the museum, and they actually have reconstructed it, I think. And I wondered if your guest knows about Cahokia.
Oh, and, yes, terrific site.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
good. And maybe he could comment on the fact that, you know, here was a civilization that did it over in the middle of a continent, clear across an ocean from Great Britain. Mm. It's just fascinating that it was probably done all over the world. Mm. So could you comment, please?
Yes, Cahokia is really the great pre-Columbian city of North America. We're looking at archaeologists now talking about it having had something like 15,000 people in its heyday, if not more. Its size was actually bigger than London was at the same time. And it's often been dismissed as being urban because people didn't really think that Native Americans built these kinds of cities. But indeed they do. And I think the other interesting, exciting thing is not only was it a huge concentration of people coming probably from all over the American bottom and maybe even further, is this interest in astronomical alignments. And, of course, it's not just the Woodhenge, the timber circle, but even some of the great mounds seem to have special alignments for lunar and solar observations. So, yes, I think there are a lot of parallels to be brought together. And in some ways, you know, just the size of the settlement, it dwarfs what we have at Durrington Walls in the Stonehenge complex.
And there's a great mystery here, too, because no one's quite sure what happened to these people.
No, that's right. There have been some really quite interesting theories of late, looking at how maybe they kind of expand outwards. And this complex that we call the Mississippian is something that then just spreads throughout the whole of the southeast of the U.S.
There's evidence of this particular group as far away as Mexico, as I understand, and also as far away as Wisconsin.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think we're going to stay with the Cahokia theme here for just a moment. Phyllis, in Maplewood, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hi. Wow, it's been my pleasure to visit Stonehenge and also up and down the Mississippi River, visit many of the mounds. And our art museum here had a wonderful exhibit of those, the Hopewell and others. So it's really a privilege to hear you speak about it. What about the idea that these different circles had some means of communication amongst them that perhaps enabled the connections between people all over the world to be much stronger in old times than we normally think of it?
Some people have suggested that sort of thing. What we're looking at, certainly in Britain at that time, is complete isolation, even from the continent of Europe. So that Stonehenge was actually built at a time when we have no cross-channel exchange or contact evidence for any of that. So I think what we really have to see is that these are entirely separate developments in different places at different times. And it's perhaps not too difficult to understand why. One of the most recent ideas about Cahokia is it is basically the foundation of a religious and cosmological cult, and it attracts migrants from all across this part of North America because they're drawn to this very special series of happenings, and subsequently that great city kind of implodes and people head on out and take these aspects of cult into different parts of the Mississippi Valley. So in Europe, what we're looking at, again, is also, I think, a series of independent developments throughout our Stone Age, the Neolithic period, and into the Bronze Age. We've discovered, archaeologists have discovered, that the earliest of these in southeast Turkey, a terrific site called Göbekli Tepe, where they're carving huge limestone pillars, arranging them within big public buildings on top of a plateau a long way from other settlements. And it's recognizing that at certain levels of social organization, societies really get into doing this. And I think one of the important reasons why they want to monumentalize aspects of the cosmos, the solstices, lunar alignments, and all the rest of it, is, of course, they're trying to kind of create heaven on earth. They're trying to show that the rulers of these normally quite hierarchical societies, they're ruling through the mandate of heaven, as you might say. So it's one way of justifying the new order.
One of the things that's striking about Stonehenge is the fact that the real estate itself is quite unremarkable. It seems very flat. There is the River Avon is not far away. Mm. But you would think if this had some special significance, it would be in a more imposing place.
Sure. Yes, we've looked at that landscape very carefully, and we've come to the conclusion that it's in the wrong spot. If you wanted to put it
now
somewhere,
you tell us.
If you wanted to put it somewhere imposing, it ought to be on top of the hill, which it is off the side of. And we've been puzzling about this for a long time. But we may possibly have come up with one of the reasons where it is, which is that when we excavated just outside of it along the avenue, we saw that that avenue had itself been built on what appears to be a natural geological feature, a pair of ridges in the chalk bedrock, which we just don't think are man-made at all. This may be more than a coincidence, because these actually run on the solstice alignment. Oh. So it raises the possibility that prehistoric people actually saw this landform, recognized that it mirrored the heavens on earth, and thought, my word, this must be a special place. It could also explain why we have one of the oldest monuments in the whole of Europe right next to Stonehenge. And it's, in fact, underneath the visitor's car park. Oh. So if you go there today, you'll see three white circles painted on the tarmac, on the asphalt. And that is where there was a line of timber posts put up almost 10,000 years ago. So that's taking us way back earlier than those early farmers into hunter-gatherers during what we call the Middle Stone Age, the Mesolithic. And archaeologists have just discovered down in the valley next to Stonehenge, there's a very big Mesolithic settlement. So it may be that this was seen as a very special spot for a long period of time, which either gets kind of reused, rediscovered, or there might even be some kind of long-term continuity.
You see, my theory is that you're dragging a 45-ton stone, you get to a hill and say, let's not go to the top of the hill, let's do it right here.
No, that's right, yes, but they've already gone over lots of hills to get there in the first place.
No, I know. I don't mean to make light of it. It's fascinating stuff and great detective work on your part, Mike Parker Pearson. A reminder that he'll be discussing his Stonehenge findings later today at Washington University's Steinberg Hall Auditorium. That's happening at 4 o'clock. And I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's been fascinating, and folks will have even more fascination this afternoon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a moment. Dr. Donald Suggs, publisher of the St. Louis American, is with us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.